Good afternoon. It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. On today's program, we'll be focusing all about bladder health. We'll be taking an overview on bladder diseases and disorders. And we hope that you join today's conversation by giving us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always email us middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio this afternoon by my co-host, Dr. Peter Roth.
Thank you, Sarah. Our featured guest today is urologist Dr. Scott Shy of the Parkview Physicians Group, who will be covering the causes, diagnoses, and treatments of a variety of bladder conditions, including the common affliction of acute infectious cystitis that affects all age groups, chronic inflammatory interstitial cystitis, a painful disorder affecting 3.3 million American women, stress incontinence, the most prevalent of all bladder disorders in our society, overactive bladder syndrome, affecting 1 out of 6 U.S. adults, and finally, bladder cancer, which is now the 6th most prevalent cancer in the United States, affecting over 500,000 patients, and often preventable and treatable cancer if diagnosed in its early stages. We'll start out with recurrent bladder infections. Dr. Shy, what causes recurrent bladder infections in children? And we'll move on eventually to young adults and the elderly. And how can these infections be prevented?
Well, thanks for having me. The general causes of UTI in children are not too different from causes of urinary tract infection in any population. You have to make a distinguishment between the newborn period and then later on in childhood. One of the things during the first year of life that we tend to see is a lot of times there's an anatomical issue. So in children that are getting urinary tract infections or acute cystitis, it's very important to rule out problems with the kidneys and the bladder, and so structural-based things, and that's where a lot of times we'll get imaging studies very early on. Circumcision does play a role for newborn males, and so there tends to be a lot of bacterial colonization and things like that, which is not important after the first year of life, but that certainly comes into play. With younger children, one of the more common things we see is something we call dysfunctional voiding. And commonly this can be referred to as holding behavior. And I'm sure a lot of parents out there have seen their children do what we call the potty dance, where they cross their legs and jump up and down. But this behavior can kind of sometimes lead to problems and ultimately infections and even kidney damage. And it generally starts off and comes about from kids, and even we see this in adults as well, but usually too busy to go to the bathroom, and they start off by just learning to control their pelvic floor muscles and hold. And as time goes by, it becomes harder and harder for them to relax those muscles, and it becomes harder and harder to pee, and that starts to become painful. And that creates a cycle in the child's mind. They start to experience discomfort, so now they really don't want to go to the bathroom, and the symptoms amplify. And you start to see constipation develop as well, which is really the sign that there's a problem. And as this becomes more and more advanced, then you start to see potential infection with bacteria and true infections. So that's that's one of the more common things that we come across in kids.
And in young adults and women often have frequent urinary tract infections. What are some of the setups for these problems?
Well, the incidence of UTI or urinary tract infection certainly increases with age. And there's a dramatic increase as women reach sexual maturity, basically. So after puberty and as women start to become more sexually active, we start to see an increased incidence of bacterial infections. That levels off, however. It's probably about 20-30% of females by the time they're age 24 have had at least one UTI. Normally, the body's defenses will kick in, and most people are not susceptible to what we call recurrent infections, and so they'll Again, you start to see a little bit of a flat line, and eventually, as women go through menopause, they lose some of their natural body defenses as they become de-estrogenized, and that's when you start to see increase as well from that point on.
And in nursing homes, this becomes a real problem once again.
Absolutely. In nursing homes, probably the highest incidence of urinary tract infections that we see. The problem, it can oftentimes be, you see a lot of catheters in nursing homes. You also tend to have a lot of bacteria that are more likely to cause infections. Generally speaking, most patients that are in nursing homes are somewhat debilitated, and their natural defenses to infection are down.
We have a listener who wrote in that has a question actually along those lines. She writes, my grandmother is having frequent UTIs and bladder infections, but her doctor keeps prescribing her meds to treat the infections. But is there anything else that she can do on her own with diet or lifestyle changes to help maybe not be on those meds so much to treat the UTIs?
Sure, that's an excellent question, and it's one that we deal with pretty much on a daily basis. One of the things that you have to decide is the infection causing symptoms? Because what we're finding nowadays is that not all bladder infections need to be treated, and in fact, sometimes just knee-jerk giving antibiotics can actually do more harm than good. So one of the first things is to truly decide, is this a symptomatic infection? And that can be difficult sometimes because a lot of times bladder infections or bacteria in the urine are blamed for certain things, and in reality, it's just a red herring and there's other things going on. But repetitive use of antibiotics is certainly not a good idea. We will sometimes use a low-dose antibiotic, a suppressive type of antibiotic, to try to keep patients' urine sterile for a while, and so that is something that can be useful. But as far as non-pharmacological ideas that you can do, just general things to try to cut down on infections, most of it has weak evidence behind it, but what I tell patients is that if you do these things, they all kind of add up, and you will usually see a difference unless there's something else going on, and that's when we start to get involved and do more of a workup. But there is truth to cranberry being beneficial. Generally, I recommend the pills, the tablet form. With cranberry juice, especially the non-diet, you're going to get extra calories and sugar, which is not beneficial. Plus, to get the amount of cranberry that you need to have an effect, you have to drink quite a bit. So you can get concentrated forms in tablet form. And there's actually, within the cranberry, there's a molecule basically that makes it hard for bacteria to latch onto the bladder surface, and that's why there is kind of truth behind that. Doing vitamin C, about 1,000 milligrams a day, is also very useful. That causes the urine to become a little bit more acidic, and generally speaking, bacteria don't like to live in an acid environment, so that's something easy and over-the-counter that you can do. Very, very important to have good bowel health. We see urinary tract infections all the time in women and men that tend to have constipation as an issue, and certainly with aging, constipation becomes a major problem. So one of the recurring themes that we'll see with bladder health is that bowel health is also tied in very intimately with it. So we recommend increasing fiber, increasing fluids, and using stool softeners if necessary. One of the newer things that we're starting to do more of, and there's actually a lot of science that's coming out behind it, is also using probiotics. And if you're not familiar with probiotics, basically they're bacteria, but non-pathogenic. It means they don't cause disease. And it's the typical bacteria that live in humans, in their gut, on their skin surface, pretty much every nook and cranny. But the idea behind it is if you replenish bacteria that's actually beneficial to your system, you're leaving less room for bacteria that tend to cause infection. And this is being used across the board in lots of specialties, both for patients that suffer with diarrhea, constipation, all kinds of ailments. But certainly when it comes to infections in the bladder, there is some benefit. And I usually recommend lactobacillus just because that tends to be the organism that you see colonized in the vagina. And it's a natural barrier to infection for most women. So I'll tell patients to try those. And, you know, I've had a pretty good response from it. So whether or not, you know, there's a true benefit, it's hard to say. But again, there's science is getting stronger behind it.
And what are the common symptoms of urinary tract infection and many of the other bladder diseases you might want to describe? Because people can confuse a bladder infection with the different incontinence syndromes and, of course, bladder cancer in its initial presentation. What do people feel when they're having a bladder infection?
Absolutely. It's the most common presenting symptom is usually discomfort with urination or some pressure. So most people describe either a burning or a pressure sensation, particularly in what we call the suprapubic region, which is right above the pubic bone where the bladder would sit. It's not uncommon to feel like you need to pee, but nothing comes out, a feeling of hesitancy, what we call it, sometimes feeling like you have to push the urine out. Urgency is also probably one of the more common symptoms. And there's a lot of overlap, like you alluded to, that with these symptoms. Urgency can be seen in overactive bladder. It can be seen and associated with bladder cancer, a whole number of bladder conditions. So, just having these symptoms, it's not necessarily straightforward. And blood in the urine is another one that's an absolute warning sign. Certainly, infection is probably one of the more common causes of having blood in the urine. But actually seeing blood in the urine is an absolute warning sign, and you should see your physician right away about that.
I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. And today we're focusing the whole hour of our program on bladder health. And to do that, we have Dr. Scott Shy, who is helping answer your questions about bladder health. 260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I wanted to ask, before we move on into some of the more complicated diseases that are associated with bladder health, what role does hydration or dehydration play in these kind of more acute infections?
That's a great question. And basically, hydration is a good thing. Mm-hmm. The problem you run into is that, especially with symptoms of urgency and frequency, the knee-jerk reaction a lot of times is to limit fluids because you don't want to be going to the bathroom all the time. But the reality is there's very few situations where hydration is actually going to be worse for you when you're talking about bladder health. Dilution of the urine is actually been shown to probably reduce the amount of potential toxicity that can affect the bladder lining. So just the way the kidneys filter, when you dilute the urine out, you're going to have less problem with the bladder. It certainly dilutes out any type of bacterial concentration as well. The other thing is when you have a dilute urine, the way that the cells interact, it actually can be preventative and actually lyse certain bad bacterial type of organisms. So hydration is important, and the other thing with that is it also will help with kidney stones, which we can often see hand in hand with urinary tract infections and other types of bladder health. So yeah, we encourage hydration. The key is non-irritating fluids, though, because you can get into trouble, especially with caffeinated beverages, alcohol, things like that, that are going to cause a lot of symptoms, and they're very well-known bladder irritants. So we generally want to stay away from those things and encourage more, obviously water is the least irritating of any substance, but there's lots of other things out there too.
So I think the bottom line is if you're having any bladder symptoms, pain on urination, frequency, urgency, see your doctor, and urine analysis will be done, urine cultures could be done, a history and physical would be done that would not only treat the infection, if it is an infection, but rule out some of the other diseases we're going to talk about. Now, chronic interstitial cystitis is a very painful condition, disrupting the lives of many women from 20 to 40 years of age, and 2.7% of women greater than 18 will have this. Tell us more about this very vexing disease and what causes it, and can it be controlled?
Sure. So interstitial cystitis is a very difficult disorder because we don't, as a scientific community, we don't quite understand it. And so it makes it very hard for us to diagnose and treat patients. And it becomes frustrating for not only the patients, but also the healthcare providers. And really what it is it's a diagnosis of exclusion. And that's the important thing. You want to absolutely make sure that there's nothing else going on before you end up with a label of interstitial cystitis. And again, it gets back to the point of if you're having these symptoms, it's very important for somebody with knowledge to evaluate you thoroughly because, again, bladder cancer, overactive bladder, pelvic floor dysfunction, infections, all these things can overlap and mimic each other. But interstitial cystitis is now, we now kind of have changed the name a little bit. We call it bladder pain syndrome or painful bladder syndrome. And we still tag interstitial cystitis along with it, but that tends to be more of a microscopic description. The key with interstitial cystitis is pain. And that's probably what distinguishes it from all of the others is that, not that you can't have pain from the other disorders, but in order to have this disorder, you have to have pain. And generally, almost always, the pain is worse as your bladder fills. And so these patients tend to have very low capacity bladders and very debilitating. Normally, I mean, they're storing urine at a capacity that may be one-tenth of what the normal bladder can hold. And so as you can imagine, it leads to a lot of urgency and frequency as well. But as that bladder fills, it becomes very painful. And if your bladder can't hold much to begin with, and you're going to be basically living chronically in pain. And that's what this is. It's a chronic pain disorder. There's a lot of theories behind what causes it, but again, we don't know. But there probably has something to do with the immune system and the way the immune system interacts with the body. And we use a lot of antihistamine medications, which we normally use for allergies and other immunological disorders. And those tend to help out. Diagnosis can be, again, it can be challenging, but usually what we would do is start with just basics, like you said, and urinalysis and history, and start to eliminate other factors before we kind of arrive on that. The key with interstitial cystitis is learning what your triggers are, because these patients tend to have very clear triggers, and they're usually dietary associated. And so a lot of it is avoidance and behavioral changes. And then beyond that, we have a lot of other strategies that have been developed over the last few years. And there's actually some good policies in place now.
We have a caller on line one. Amy, welcome to Health 360.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a 9-year-old. And he is still wetting the bed. We've tried getting him to go to the bathroom before bed, maybe not drinking until after 6. He also has seizures and he's on medication. I just wondered if those two related together. And also, should I be concerned that he's still wetting the bed? He's very upset about it. You know, sleepovers are difficult. So I just wondered if there's anything I can do about it other than what I'm already doing.
Sure. So bedwetting is frustrating, and the key here is that it's okay that he's still bedwetting. It's still normal. We usually kids can wet the bed up to age 13 before we start to consider it somewhat abnormal, but it's a challenging thing to deal with, and obviously he's upset about it. He doesn't want to be wetting the bed. It creates a lot of frustration, you know, between the parent and the child as well. So it is still normal, and most kids, the older they get, the more likely they are to grow out of it. bedwetting tends to be more of a sleep disorder, actually, now that we understand it a little bit better. There certainly is a rare minority of the time where there could be an anatomical problem. And so that's, if it becomes more of an issue, that's where you can really get benefit from sitting down, you know, face-to-face with the physician and doing an exam and kind of deciding whether or not an ultrasound or some other type of imaging is appropriate. But generally speaking, this is a behavioral disorder and it's a sleep disorder. These children tend to be very deep sleepers, very hard to arouse. They spend much more time in a deep sleep state. And the only thing that's ever been proven to effectively treat bedwetting is actually a bed alarm. And so these, you can find these at various health stores, and they have different models, and they range in price, and they're not cheap. But basically, it's a pad that lays down, and once it senses moisture, it sends off a very shrill alarm. And the whole idea is to try to force the child to wake up as they're having an accident. And it basically, that repetitiveness of waking up when they're having the accident will eventually lead to a trigger, a neural pathway being formed so that they're going to start waking up before that happens. You can kind of simulate that as well if you kind of set the alarm for them and try to, you know, wake them up at some point in the night before they're wet and get them to go to the bathroom. And so there's things like that. We'll occasionally use medication as a crutch. And I say that because it's not really treating the problem, but it can help out. And especially, you know, if your child's going to go to a sleepover or something, they're very embarrassed. It's affecting their quality of life. There are some medications that are really effective at keeping them dry, and they can be used. They certainly have side effects and have to be monitored closely, but there are other things that we can do.
We need to take a short break here on Health 360, but if you have a question or comment, feel free to give us a call, 260-452-1185. Thanks very much for your call, Amy. You can always email us middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page. We'll be back in just a few moments. This is 89.1 FM WBOY.
Spring is a time when flowers bloom, gardens grow, and public radio listeners pledge. WBOI's Spring Fun Drive is April 20th through the 28th. And if you'd like to help answer phones, go to nipr.fm and click on Volunteer under the Support tab. Basic computer skills are required.
You help pay for public education in Indiana, but from the Capitol to the classroom, the payback isn't always clear. You can find out how the state's policy impacts your family in our new State Impact Indiana Project, a local national collaboration between Indiana public broadcasting stations and NPR. You can hear the stories during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition on NIPR, and dig deeper with a click on the State Impact logo at nipr.fm.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by United Way of Allen County, working together with 15 local early childhood and youth-serving organizations to help kids in the community be prepared for learning in school and beyond. UWEducationNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOY. The time is 12:30. If you have a question or comment, feel free to give us a call at 260-452-1185. We'd love to hear from you. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined by our guest this afternoon, Dr. Scott Shy, and my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Dr. Shy, there's been some recent evidence that people with the chronic interstitial cystitis have a problem in repairing their damaged bladder linings and this antiproliferative factor. Could you tell us more about that?
Sure, yeah. This is something that through basic science research has started to gain a lot of promise. And basically, this is a molecule that they've discovered, and it's implicated in bladder repair, basically. And they're finding that there's a very high correlation between patients with interstitial cystitis that have been studied with having this factor. It's a very specific and sensitive marker, which means it's a very useful, potential useful test to try to distinguish this disorder from others. And patients that don't have interstitial cystitis tend not to have this. It goes back to one of the theories behind interstitial cystitis, which is that the lining, which we call a glycosaminoglycan layer, which is involved in the bladder, the superficial bladder lining, in patients with IC, they tend to develop gaps in this lining, and actually we call almost like a leaky bladder on the inside. So it allows chemicals and other toxins that are in the urine to seep through the bladder lining and get into the deeper layers, which then triggers an immune response. And ultimately, these responses can lead to changes in the way that the neurons basically send signals back and forth to the brain, and you end up with these chronic pain pathways. And so it's a very interesting field, and there's a lot being done with it. And certainly the anti-proliferative factor is probably the most encouraging thing that we've seen from a clinical standpoint in years. And so it's probably, you know, in terms of an actual test, it's years away from being available, but I think it'll certainly help the field.
Great. Stress incontinence is the most prevalent bladder disorder in our society, and it's often confused with overactive bladder syndrome, which, as mentioned earlier, affects 1 out of 6 adults, male and female. And could you describe what are these conditions and how do they differ and who is affected by them?
Sure. So stress incontinence in general is a common problem. And unfortunately, it's rather taboo even today in our culture to talk about incontinence or to be wet. And so unfortunately, I think a lot of times, and you know, my experience in talking with patients is that people tend to feel embarrassed. They don't want to share these things. They think this is just the fact of getting older and I have to deal with this. And so unfortunately, it delays treatment, and certainly there can be other causes other than just what we've, you know, referred to as aging changes. But when you look at incontinence, it's a very broad category, but it generally, we think about stress incontinence and urge incontinence as being two of the main contributors. Stress incontinence tends to be an anatomical problem, and this is a problem of support. And we generally see increased risk of stress incontinence with childbirth. What we know now is that there's probably some genetic factors involved in terms of the tissue makeup, collagen and elastin makeup, some of the support structures in our bodies, and genetically some women are more predisposed to having impairment in that. There's other factors as well. Chronic coughing, so patients that have chronic coughs or smokers that tend to cough a lot, anything that's putting continual pressure or stress on the pelvis tends to weaken those support structures. And so stress incontinence happens when, and by stress we mean just increased pressure in the abdomen pushing on the bladder. And so that bladder then causes the bladder to push down. It changes the angles of the bladder neck and the urethra, and it leads to leakage. leakage. That's opposed to urge incontinence, which is a leakage that happens when you get the sensation that you have to pee really bad. And so urgency is this sensation that will come on out of the blue of, I've got to get to the bathroom now. And so one of the more common things is you walk into a room, and if the first thing you're looking for is a bathroom, then you probably have some urgency. And if you can't make it to the bathroom in time and you're leaking with those urges, that's urge incontinence. And that is a tends not to be an anatomical problem. It's more of a medical and a bladder level problem. And so there's that has implications in how we treat those disorders. And there can be overlap. You can have both as well.
We need to take a quick break for the news here on WBOY. And we have a few calls coming in about bladder cancer, which is where our conversation is headed when we come back from this break. So please do stay with us. I wanted to share a quick comment before we do take a break. A listener wrote in saying, regarding the call about bedwetting, I wet the bed until I was in the fifth grade, so I know exactly what your son is going through. I was not treated in any way with any techniques, therapies, or medications. I was just told I had an underdeveloped bladder, and eventually I grew out of that. Is that something that is possible, Dr. Shai?
Sure, yeah. Most bedwetting will resolve on its own. The older you get, the more likely you are to grow out of it. So, but again, once you start to get into the school level and everything else, and it becomes more of a social problem, doing behavioral techniques and bed alarms and things like that can improve the chances of getting better.
Thanks for sharing that comment. We'll be back with more of Health 360 here on WBOY in just a few moments.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by PHP, offering a variety of health benefits and services for individuals, families, and businesses in Northern Indiana, including medical, dental, high deductible, administrative services, and more at PHPNI.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Sean Beter with WBOI News. IPFW is cutting jobs to help close an $8.4 million budget deficit. Chancellor Vicki Carwine has told faculty and staff that 39 full-time and 2 part-time positions will be eliminated through layoffs and attrition by the end of June. An email sent to IPFW staff indicates that administrators expect the job cuts to save $2.2 million. Other savings will come through a 2% tuition increase next fall, a pay freeze, and cuts in activities, utilities, and services. IPFW has said the deficit stems from state funding shortfalls and much lower enrollment last fall. Governor Mike Pence pitched his income tax proposal to mayors and local government leaders who visited the State House Tuesday to promote their own priorities to the legislature. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith has more.
Governor Mike Pence's proposed across-the-board 10% income tax cut hasn't been backed by many in the General Assembly, even his fellow Republicans. And its reception among the dozens of mayors and town leaders at the State House Tuesday might also be described as lukewarm. But Pence says his proposal will help more people than other tax cuts lawmakers are considering.
By lowering the personal income tax rate, you benefit 83% of businesses in this state by putting more in their bottom line, and you provide 4.4 million middle-class Hoosiers with much-needed tax relief during a tough economy.
Evansville Mayor Lloyd Winicky says his city's focus is on other issues more critical to the local community, but he says he hasn't taken a firm position on Pence's proposal.
I certainly understand the governor's thought and do buy into the principle that more money into the pocketbooks of Hoosiers will help the economy and will certainly help create jobs. Whether now is the right time or to do it or not, I would leave to the men and women of the legislature.
Pence says greater collaboration between state and local governments on economic development and education are also priorities of his administration. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And the fuselage of a private jet that struck 3 Indiana houses, killing 2 people and injuring 3 others, has been removed from a house and awaits investigation by authorities who've yet to determine a cause. All South Bend residents evacuated following Sunday's crash, except for the 3 homes that were struck, were allowed to return on Tuesday. The private jet crashed near the South Bend Regional Airport, killing two men aboard, including former Oklahoma University quarterback Steve Davis. It was not immediately clear who was at the controls when the plane crashed. You're listening to Midday Matters Health 360 here on WBOI Fort Wayne.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. The time is 12:40. If you'd like to join today's conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Midday Matters Facebook page. That's just Midday Matters. Or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. We're focusing today's conversation on bladder health. And to do that, we have Dr. Scott Shy, who's in with us, helping answer your questions. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I also have in the studio my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Dr. Shy, urge incontinence is a manifestation of overactive bladder syndrome, a very common condition among older people. Could you give us a brief rundown on what this is and some of the newer therapies involved before we talk about bladder cancer?
Sure. So, you know, we call it OAB, which is or overactive bladder, and really it's just a term that was made up to describe urgency. And there's a lot of overlap, again, with all of these symptoms, frequency and other pain to some extent. But urgency is the key with overactive bladder. And without getting into too much detail, you can have urge incontinence with it, which can obviously be devastating. The general treatments for overactive bladder tend to be dietary and behavioral based, and then pharmacological. And for a long time, it's all we had. And I think a lot of patients still kind of feel or believe or are unfortunately told that that's all we have. And the problem with the medications is not that they don't work. They do. But after about a year, the majority of patients, well over 60% or so, will have stopped their medication. And these are expensive agents, but they do work well. And I don't think it's a cost issue so much as it's a side effect issue. And you can develop very severe constipation, dry mouth, other problems. And so we've really not had many other options, unfortunately. But over the last few years, there's been several major advances. One of the techniques that we use is called an InterStim. And this is a remarkable device. And it's actually been around for over 10 years, and it's FDA approved, and the results are quite striking with it. But one of the main indications that we use it for is overactive bladder, so urgency and frequency that's not responding to more basic treatments, and also urge incontinence. And in order to have this device, we do a test, and the test has to show 50% improvement. So you can imagine somebody who's maybe goes to the bathroom 20 times a day and has 3 or 4 episodes of leakage. If you can tell that person at the minimum, you're going to only go to the bathroom 10 times a day now and only be wet once or twice, that's a huge quality of life improvement. And our experience with it is that most people get even better response. But it's a it's an electrode. It's a lead that gets put into the back, not unlike other electrodes that are used for different neurological disorders and pain disorders. It goes into the nerve root of one of the main nerves that affects the bladder. And then there's an implantable battery that sends impulses, and this can be controlled from the outside world with a remote. So it's a nice procedure, and it works very well. One of the other things that actually just recently became FDA approved for overactive bladder, we've been using it for years now on neurogenic bladders, so patients that have neurologic causes for their urgency and frequency, is Botox, actually. And Botox has a wide range of applications. It's not just for pretty faces, but Botox, when it's injected in the bladder, can actually create a dramatic response and eliminate a lot of urgency and frequency. And it's revolutionized the way that we are able to take care of these patients. So,
okay, we want to talk about bladder cancer, which is not only the sixth most popular, if you want to say popular, or most prevalent cancer in our society, but will account for 72,000 new cases this year and 15,000 deaths. What are the causes? Is it preventable? Who gets it? And what are the diagnostic and treatment regimens?
So bladder cancer is a devastating disease, and I'm glad we're talking about it. I don't think there's a lot of awareness about bladder cancer, and patients are always surprised to learn that smoking is actually probably the biggest risk factor for bladder cancer that we know of. Obviously, we know that smoking's not good for you, that it causes cancer and other diseases, but to hear that it causes bladder cancer is a lot of times I've seen a lot of shock and disbelief. And in practice, I would say that at least 9 out of 10 patients that come in with bladder cancer are smokers or have smoked in the past. Smoking does increase your risk by fourfold, and it takes about 20 to 30 years of smoking cessation before you reduce your risk back to normal. So that's a lot worse odds than other cancers, like, for example, even lung cancer, where when you stop smoking, you start to reduce your risk much more rapidly. So with bladder cancer, the risk tends to hang around. There's other risk, mostly occupational risk, and those tend to be occupations that have aromatic dye exposure, so aniline dyes we see in the tool and dye industry, rubber workers, people around in the tire industry, things like that, sometimes painters and plumbers, anybody that's having exposures. Not in the United States, but in other countries, there is increased risk from arsenic exposures. There's also increased risk from an organism particularly found in Egypt called Schistosomia, which can also lead to bladder cancer. So there's other more rare causes, but in general, when you think bladder cancer, you think of smoking. The most common presentation of bladder cancer is blood in the urine. And oftentimes it's microscopic. And so a lot of times this will be picked up on a urinalysis, just a routine health screen, maybe for a job or maybe just an annual check. But it's the reason why when we hand you a cup to pee in, we're doing it for a big reason. And it's because if there's blood under the microscope, that's not normal. And it will immediately trigger a very specific evaluation. And that evaluation can save your life. So that's a key. One of the things that we see, unfortunately, a lot of, though, is people that actually see blood in their urine and either ignore it or write it off, or they seek treatment and are told knee-jerk that it's just an infection, take some antibiotics, and you'll be better. And so they do that, and then the blood comes back, and either they say, oh, it's just the infection again, or they're treated with more antibiotics. And really, you're potentially missing a major problem here. And so a lot of times there's subtle clues that can point us in the direction that this may be more than just an infection.
And the staging and the of the cancer itself, you then hopefully the patient is referred to the urologist, and what do you then do in your diagnostic techniques and the staging of the severity of the condition?
So fortunately, 70% of bladder cancer presents early stage, and what I tell patients when I think about bladder cancer, I think about two different types of cancer. I think about the majority of bladder cancer, which initially is what we call low stage, low grade. It's not aggressive. And then there's also a more devastating bladder cancer, which is invasive or high-grade cancer. And those are two different animals. They behave very differently. And so that's kind of the first thing we think about. Most bladder cancer is what we used to call transitional cell, and now we call urothelial cell, but it's a cancer of the lining of the bladder. There are more rare forms of bladder cancer. One is adenocarcinoma, which can oftentimes come from the bowel or other areas of the bladder. And then there's squamous cancer of the bladder, which we see in patients that have had chronic infections and also long-term indwelling catheters, things like that. But the majority of bladder cancer is urothelial cell. And what we do is if there's concern for it, if we've picked this up, the guidelines that are in place recommend a cystoscopy, which is an office-based procedure typically, although there are some exceptions. But basically, we need to look in the bladder. And that is really the key test. We also do an imaging test, and nowadays CT scans are superior. And unless there's a contraindication to doing a CT, we would also stage with a CT. Once the tumor is diagnosed, once we know that that's what it is, the first step is going to the operating room and resecting it. And we do this through a scope, and so there's no incisions involved. This is a procedure that's done what we call transurethrally. So it's a scope that goes in through the urethra, and we're able to actually visualize the whole bladder and the urethra, and then we can take biopsies if we need to, and then we can actually cut out the tumor. And in doing this, it's oftentimes the full treatment that we need to do, but it also gives us the diagnosis and allows us to stage the cancer. And from that point forward, then we can decide what needs to be done.
And the surgical and chemotherapeutic and radiation therapies available today are?
So there's a bunch of options, but the standard of care would be to do a transurethral resection. Now, what we're doing more of nowadays is after we've resected a tumor, immediately afterwards, we will put an agent in the bladder, a chemotherapeutic agent. The most commonly used one is called mitomycin C. And that's an alkylating agent, and it basically kills cancer cells. And what that has done is it actually has reduced the risk of recurrence of bladder cancer, because one of the things about bladder cancer is that it has, even if it's early stage and low grade, it has a very high preponderance to come back. So for the most non-invasive bladder cancer there is, which is a low-grade TA cancer, there's still about a 40% chance that that will come back in your lifetime. And so any patient that gets diagnosed with bladder cancer, even if it's treated successfully, has to go on to a surveillance program. And it's very, very important for these patients to maintain their surveillance because they can recur, and oftentimes they do. The more aggressive the cancer, the more likely it is to recur, the more likely it is to progress, which means it goes from a cancer that's not life-threatening to now one that is. But so the mitomycin C is cut down on a lot of the recurrence. If we take the tumor out and it's not invasive into the muscle and the patient, but it is high grade, what we'll oftentimes do is give patients BCG. And BCG is actually an attenuated form of tuberculosis. And it's the same thing that in other countries, not ours, but they would use to vaccinate patients against TB. And we actually have found somewhat serendipitously, that putting BCG in the bladder actually causes a vigorous immune response, and it allows the body to actually attack and kill bladder cancer. And so we have a lot of patients that we'll then treat with regimens where they come in once a week for 6 weeks, then often go onto a maintenance schedule where they have BCG put in their bladder. And this significantly reduces the chance of progression and recurrence. Beyond that, we'll occasionally have to take patients back for re-resections and things like that. Bladder cancer changes when it gets involved with the bladder muscle. So if as it goes deeper into the muscle, as it becomes more aggressive, the treatments that I was talking about no longer become effective. At that point, the gold standard, really the one chance at your best chance, is a radical surgery, meaning a major cancer operation. And these are the patients that end up losing their bladders. So we take out their bladders. We take out, if it's a male, we take out the prostate, which is often involved. We take out an extensive amount of lymph nodes, and then we have to either create a new bladder or create an area for the urine to drain through a stoma, or what we call a conduit. And so there's various options with that. There are bladder-sparing therapies, and for some patients that they would prefer to try a bladder-sparing therapy. For some patients, they're just not healthy enough to undergo a major surgery. And so for those patients, we tend to try to do aggressive resections in the OR, and then complement that with radiation and chemotherapy. The short-term results with radiation and chemotherapy are decent. The long-term effects are not as good as surgery, but you can see some durable response from chemotherapy and radiation. The problem is you can become a bladder cripple. When you put radiation into the bladder, it causes the bladder a lot of times to become scarred and lose its capacity. And so you end up with, again, some of the stuff we've been talking about earlier in the show, which with pain and urgency and frequency, and it really can affect the quality of life. So those are all things that come into play.
And the long-term outlook, and I gather if a patient gets to you early in the game, what is the long-term prognosis and longevity of bladder cancer patients?
If it's found early, excellent. If it's found early and a patient adheres to a surveillance protocol, for low-stage bladder cancer, you can expect to live a normal quality and length of life. The numbers start to get abysmal, however, when you start to see the high-grade cancers that are into the muscle. So if you have a high-grade cancer that's in the muscle and you go ahead and have full treatment and surgery and there's not any lymph node involvement, you still have about a 75 or 80% chance of disease, what we call disease-free survival at 5 and up to 10 years. As the disease progresses outside of the bladder, those numbers start to fall to 60 and then 50%. And then as it gets into the lymph nodes, it actually falls down to 30%. So it's a very devastating disease the more advanced it gets. If you took all comers, it's probably about a 50 to 60% chance of disease-specific survival at 10 years. But that's accounting for all types of the disease.
And it mainly seems to affect older white males. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the highest incidences in older Caucasians. As a whole, bladder cancer is increasing in prevalence. And so, as you alluded to, you said it, you know, the sixth most common cancer, and prior to that, it was not even that high. So it's gaining ground, and we're not quite sure why at this point. And certainly, we know that smoking causes bladder cancer, but you would think that there has to be some sort of other environmental factor or something that's leading to that.
Well, if you're somebody that has bladder cancer in their family history, should you be more concerned, and should you seek out some of those imaging tests that we talked about earlier?
That's a great question, and with most cancers, there is a familial preponderance, and you know, certainly genetics play a role. To my knowledge, bladder cancer does not tend to have an inheritance pattern. There's certainly there's a lot of genes and chromosomes that are involved in bladder cancer. The best studied one is a tumor suppressor gene called P53, and that's common through a lot of cancers. But there's not any good evidence to suggest that if your father had bladder cancer, that you're more likely to develop it. You may be more likely to develop it if he was a smoker and you were around the smoking or, that kind of thing. But as far as a definite genetic inheritance pattern, it's not high, not to the point where I would suggest that you have to get surveillance or anything like that. But certainly if you're seeing a physician once a year just as a routine health check, urinalysis should be included in that. And that's where you're going to pick up potentially blood in the urine. And that's where we would pick up from there.
I think the big message today is if you're having any bladder symptoms, pain, frequency, blood in the urine, get to the doctor. It may be anything from a mild infection to a severe cancer, and putting off the visit to the doctor, putting off your urinalysis, will cause problem in the long run. And in this cancer, the quicker you get it treated, your survival rates are excellent.
Absolutely.
We have just about a minute left in today's program, and Dr. Shai, I wanted to make sure you got to, if people are looking for your services or want to talk to you further, how can they get a hold of you?
Sure, thanks. So I'm a member of Parkview Physicians Group Urology. There's six of us, and we all provide excellent urological care to the community, and I'm real fortunate to be a part of this group. And our number to the office is 260-482-8681. That's probably the most direct way to get a hold of us, and we'd be happy to help out any way we could.
Thanks so much for being a part of Health 360 today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 in HD Channel 1, and we're streaming online at our website, which is nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. Thanks very much for listening to the program today. It will be podcasted by the end of the day to our website, nipr.fm. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.